Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the June edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. This first article is out of the prologue section, and it is written by Ben Cryer, titled Unnatural Wonder: The Surprising Human Interventions That Help Make Niagara Falls So Awe-Inspiring. Niagara Falls has seen plenty of dramatic stunts over the centuries, ever since a local hotel owner sent a condemned ship with a cargo of ferocious animals over the falls in 1827. Only the goose survived the plunge. But no feat has attracted more visitors than a scientific survey conducted in 1969. That year, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers turned off American Falls. The engineers wanted to find a way to remove the unseemly boulders that had piled up at its base since 1931, cutting the height of the falls in half. But the study itself proved more appealing than any improvement they could recommend. The first weekend after the dewatering, about 100,000 people showed up to see this natural wonder without its liquid veil. The performance will have an encore at some point in the coming years when New York State once again dewaters American Falls. The purpose this time is more pedestrian, to replace two bridges, but the process will be the same. Engineers will construct a dam between the American bank of the Niagara River and the eastern tip of Goat Island, stopping the flow of water, nearly 76,000 gallons every second, over the 11-story drop. Will crowds show up this time? Photos from 1969 suggest the bedrock is nothing special to behold. Without water, American Falls is merely a cliff. And yet, the spectacle fulfills a fantasy older than the American nation: human mastery over nature. To sap the falls completely would seem to be the ultimate triumph. But, in fact, Niagara Falls was long ago brought to heel. The falls, American Falls, Horseshoe Falls, and the small Bridal Veil Falls, formed some 12,000 years ago, when water from Lake Erie carved a channel to Lake Ontario. The name Niagara came from Ugiagra, as the area well known in the language of the Iroquois people, who settled there originally. After the French explorer Samuel de Champlain described the falls in 1604, word of the magnificent sight spread through Europe. To visit Niagara Falls was practically a religious experience. When I felt how near to my Creator I was standing, Charles Dickens wrote in 1842, the first effect, and the endearing one, instant lasting, of the tremendous spectacle was peace. Alexis de Tocqueville described a profound and terrifying obscurity on his visit in 1831, but he also recognized that the falls were not as invincible as they seemed. "Hasten," Tocqueville urged a friend in a letter, "or your Niagara will have been spoiled for you." To many, these cataracts were not natural wonders, but natural resources. When Tocqueville visited, factories already encroached on the water's edge. In 1894, King C. Gillette, the future razor magnate, predicted Niagara Falls could become part of a city called Metropolis with 600 million people. A few years later, Nikola Tesla designed one of the first hydroelectric plants near the falls. He saw it as a high point in human history. It signifies the subjugation of natural forces to the service of man. Niagara Falls today is the result of the push and pull of exploitation and preservation. The Free Niagara Movement successfully lobbied to create a park around the site in the 1880s. But the changes continued. In 1950, the United States and Canada decided to divert 50% of the water from Niagara Falls through underwater tunnels to electric turbines during peak tourist hours. At night, the water flow over the falls is cut in half again. Engineers manipulate the flow using 18 gates upstream. The historian Daniel McFarlane has called the modern falls a completely man-made and artificial cataract. Ironically, this has maintained them as a tourist attraction. People want to see the image they recognize from postcards. But the Niagara Falls, left to its own devices, is one of the fastest eroding falls in the world. It has moved 7 miles since it formed. The diversion of water has helped reduce the rate of erosion by more than 85%. The engineers who built the diversion tunnels also made several modifications to the actual falls. They evacuated both edges of Horseshoe Falls to create a visually pleasing crest. The 1969 dewatering was another aesthetic intervention, but the engineers decided, surprisingly, to leave the fallen boulders alone. Recent emphasis on environmental values has raised questions about changing natural conditions, even for demonstrated natural and measurable social benefits, they wrote in their final report. At some point, the United States and Canada will face the same dilemma again. Do they intervene to maintain the falls or let natural processes unfold? Even with the decreased rate of deterioration, the falls regress a little every year. In about 15,000 years, the cliff edge will reach a riverbed of soft shale, and then nature will upstage any human efforts. Niagara Falls will crumble and irrevocably disappear. In a sidebarred article, cataract surgery. One June day, 50 years ago, engineers tackled a seemingly impossible feat, turning off American Falls. Rock slides in 1931 and 1954 left more than 250,000 tons of shale and dolomite at the base of the falls. Engineers wanted to study how it might be removed. To turn off the cataract, bulldozers and dump trucks fighting a 10-mile-per-hour current pushed 27,800 tons of earth across the 600-foot-wide river. Instead of diverting the water to Horseshoe Falls, engineers used the International Control Dam to redirect more than 59,000 gallons per second to hydroelectric plants. With the river slowed to a trickle, a sprinkler system kept the rock face of the American Falls wet to prevent heat and wind damage. A crane dangling an 8-foot-wide cage lowered workers to the cliff face to remove loose boulders and install meters to measure rock movement. And lastly, after 6 months of topographic, geological, and seismic studies of the dry falls, engineers decided to leave the rocks at the base. Two corpses found there were removed. Next up out of the prologue section under Art is Pride and Prejudice by Amy Crawford, interpreting the legacy of the Stonewall Uprising 50 years later. It began as just another Friday night at the Stonewall Inn, a popular New York gay bar. The raid by the NYPD Public Morals Squad in the early hours of June 28, 1969 would have been routine too, except this time, tired of harassment, the bar's patrons fought back. The unplanned uprising launched the gay rights movement, but 50 years later, Stonewall is one of those events that's both remembered and misremembered, says Carmen Hamel, co-curator of Nobody Promised You Tomorrow, at the Brooklyn Museum. The exhibition looks at Stonewall's legacy through the work of LGBTQ artists born after 1969. From reverent tributes to that night's forgotten trans heroines to posters parroting the prejudice that sexual and gender minorities still face, these artists pick at the threads of an unfinished historical narrative. It's a movement of celebration, but also of reflection, says Philippe Baez, whose mixed media image honors queer love in times of struggle. We still have a lot of work to do. Next up, also out of the prologue section under Technology, an article by Clive Thompson. It's titled, "The First Computers Were Human." It's ironic that women today must fight for equality in Silicon Valley. After all, their math skills helped launch the digital age. Tracy Chu is a 31-year-old programmer and an absolute rock star, as her former boss, Ben Silberman, the CEO and co-founder of Pinterest, once gushed to me. She's a veteran of some of Silicon Valley's biggest names. She interned at Google and Facebook, then was an early hire at the question-answering site Quora, where she coded key early features like its ranking algorithm and its weekly emailer software. At Pinterest, she helped overhaul the entire code base, making the service speedier and more reliable. These days, she's the founder of Block Party, a startup making tools to help social media users deal with harassment. Yet for all her street cred, Chow still finds herself grappling with one of the biggest problems in the industry. Female programmers are regarded skeptically and sometimes even treated with flat-out hostility. She's seen the same patterns of behavioral personally during her decade in coding. colleagues who doubt women's technical chops or who muse openly about whether women are biologically less wired to be great programmers. She has watched as women linger in jobs while men of equal or lesser ability get promoted. At other firms, she's heard of tales of flat-out harassment, including on-site propositions for sex. Chow's even subject to skepticism herself. Recently, she was trying to hire a coder for her new startup when the guy accidentally sent her a diary in which he'd meticulously written complaints about her skills. He felt I was immature and awkward and very sensitive and not good with people. In over my head, she says. And this from a guy trying to get her to hire him. Not everyone in the field is antagonistic to women, of course, but the treatment's bad enough, often enough, that the number of women coders has remarkably regressed over time, from about 35% in 1990 to 26% in 2013, according to the American Association of University Women. Chow and others are working hard to change things. She has co-founded groups like Project Include. She has co-founded groups like Project Include that encourage diversity in computer science, while another initiative lobbies venture capital firms to set up anti-harassment policies. I think we're getting better, but very slowly, Chow tells me. There's a deep irony here, because women were in computing from its earliest days. Indeed, they were considered essential back when computers weren't even yet machines. Just before the digital age emerged, computers were humans, sitting at tables and doing math laboriously by hand. Yet they powered everything from astronomy to war and the race into space. And for a time, a large portion of them were women. The rise of human computers began in the early hunt for Halley's Comet. The astronomer, Edmund Halley, had predicted that the celestial body would return and that the laws of gravity could predict precisely when. But those calculations would be too complex and brutal a task for any single astronomer. So the French mathematician, Alexis Claude Clairaut, decided to break the work up by dividing the calculations among several people. In 1757, he sat down with two friends, the young astronomer Jérôme-Joseph Lalande and Nicole Reine Lapetou, a clockmaker's wife with a penchant for numbers. At the time, women had little opportunity in science, but Lalande loved women, especially brilliant women, and promoted them in both word and deed, the historian Ken Alder has written. After arduous weeks of cranking away, the trio predicted that the comet's closest approach to the sun would be between March 15th and May 15th the next year. They were slightly off. The comet rounded the sun on March 13th, 2 days early, but it was the most accurate forecast yet. The age of human computers began. And not a moment too soon. By the 19th century, scientists and governments were beginning to collect realms of data that needed to be processed, particularly in astronomy, navigation, and surveying. So they began breaking their calculations down into tiny basic math problems and hiring gangs of people to solve them. The work wasn't always hard, though it required precision and an ability to work for long hours. Mostly, the computers were young men. But by the late 19th century, some scientists realized that hiring women could reduce the cost of computation. The growth of education and middle-class prosperity had produced a generation of young women trained in math. So when the Harvard Observatory decided to process years of astronomical data it had gathered using its telescope, it assembled one all-female team of computers. They could be paid as little as less than half of what men got, notes David Allen Greer, author of When Computers Were Human. By supply and demand and all the other nasty things, they can hire them more cheaply than men, Greer says, and the chief observer brags about it. During World War I, the Army hired a small group of women to calculate artillery trajectories. In the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration began hiring its own human calculators to support engineers. Women were welcome as computers partly because the work was viewed as dull, low-status activities. Men with elite educations generally wanted no part in it. Not only were women hired, but so were blacks, polio survivors, Jews, and others who were routinely iced out of job opportunities, Greer points out. The reason that these pre-electronic computation jobs were feminized is that they were seen as rote and de-skilled, says Mar Hicks, a historian and author of Programmed Inequality. It wasn't true, though. In a lot of cases, the women doing these computation jobs actually had to have pretty advanced math skills and math training, especially if they were doing very complex calculations. The work could require superhuman endurance, though. They had to keep working 8 hours a day doing the same equation over and over again. It must have been mind-numbing, notes Paul Ceruzzi, author of Reckoners, The Prehistory of the Digital Computer. Decades later, one human computer, Marilyn Heisen, recalled the job as intellectually interesting, but a marathon. I had moments when I said, "Did I go to college for this job?" she told Sarah McLennan, an assistant professor at Virginia State University. In World War II, the need for computers exploded. Over 200 women were hired at the University of Pennsylvania's Moore School of Electrical Engineering, creating artillery trajectory tables for the Army. By 1944, as Greer documents, about half of all computers were women. One contractor of the Applied Mathematics panel used the term "kilo girl" to refer to 1,000 hours of female calculation work. Another astronomer spoke of "girl years." Few expected that computing would lead to a career, though. The idea was mostly to use the women before they married. Astronomer L. J. Comrie wrote a 1944 Mathematical Gazette article entitled "Careers for Girls," in which he declared that female computers were useful in the years before they or many of them graduate to married life and become experts with the housekeeping accounts. After the war ended, the space race was on, and it had a ravening need for computation, crunching numbers on projects like wind tunnel tests of wings. The National Advisory Committee for Aerodynamics, or NACA, the precursor to NASA, hired several hundred women as computers at its Langley base in Virginia, the historian Beverly Galimba estimated. NACA and NASA were relatively progressive employers, paying the young women far better than they'd get in other forms of office work. They even employed married women with children. One woman who stumbled into the field in the late 1950s was Sue Finley. "I loved math," she tells me. She studied logic in college and was disenchanted with the sales and typing jobs on offer after she graduated. One day, while applying at an engineering firm, she was offered work as a computer and found joy in its rigor and puzzle solving. Later, she landed a computing job with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where she labored all day using a clattering, breadbox-sized electronic Friedan calculating machine. It was, she says, a remarkable egalitarian oasis in the 1950s America. "The engineers, the male engineers, always listened to us," she notes. At its bases, NASA employed nearly 80 black women as computers, says Margot Lee Shetterly, author of Hidden Figures. One of them, Katherine Johnson, was so revered for her abilities that in 1962, John Glenn asked her to personally verify the flight path of his first launch into space on the Friendship 7 mission. The astronauts didn't trust the newfangled digital computers, which were prone to crashing. Glenn wanted human eyes on the problem. "They had a tremendous amount of respect for these women and their mathematical abilities," says Shetterly. "The male engineers often were not good mathematicians. So the women made their work possible. Still, some friction existed. Women who asked for promotions got stonewalled or turned down. For women who wanted to move up, who wanted to be supervisors, particularly if that involves supervising men, not so much." Soon, the human computers faced an even more existential threat: digital computers, which promised to work with far greater speed and to handle complex math, like inverting a 10x10 matrix beyond the ken of even the most adroit human with a pencil. Women, though, were among the original coders of these strange new digital brains, because in the early days, programming, too, was seen as dull work. The earliest programmers for the ENIAC, the military-funded first programmable general-purpose computer, were entirely women, plucked from the ranks of the Army's human computers. And though they wound up inventing brilliant coding techniques, they received none of the glory. When the Army showed off the ENIAC to the press, running lightning-fast ballistics, crunching algorithms, it didn't introduce the women who had written the code. By the 1960s and 70s, human computation was dying. But some women made the transition to the new world of software, including Sue Finley. After taking a week-long course on the language Fortran, She began a decades-long career coding on NASA's space missions, including software that tackled probes to Venus. At 82, she remains at work as an engineer in the Deep Space Network. She also works on entry, descent, and landing of spacecraft, and still thrills to the mental challenge of debugging some gnarly problem in the code that peers into space. It's a mystery solving a mystery, she tells me. It's fun when it's successful. In one sense, the story of female computers stands in appealing contrast to the difficulties faced by women in coding today. After all, even in the more straightforwardly sexist decades of the 19th and early 20th centuries, women were accepted and even sought out for their skills. Why is it worse now? Finley sometimes talks to young women in software and is appalled by their tales of harassment and having their work ignored. Research by Sue Gardner, the former head of the Wikimedia Foundation, has found that women in the software industry often leave in mid-career. They start off excited and happy, but after a decade are ground down. Finley understands. Why would anyone want to work in those conditions and circumstances or go into that field? She asks rhetorically. Though women programmers have made strides in some fields, such as front-end programming for browser applications, the salaries in those specialties tend to be lower overall, simply because the industry regards anything being done by a woman as easy. According to Miriam Posner, an assistant professor of computer science at UCLA, it is becoming a pink-collar ghetto in coding, Posner notes, rather like the status of female human computers. Tracy Chow is cautiously optimistic. There's certainly more conversation these days in Silicon Valley about the need to hire and promote women as readily as men. Hopefully, some of the public posturing does end up forcing people to do something, she says wryly. Calculations can be solved once and for all. Social problems are harder. Now, this sidebar article seems kind of interesting, titled Number Crunchers. It's a brief history of calculators, from pebbles in the sand to Alexa. Starting in 300 BC, the counting board. Greek market vendors recorded sales by placing pebbles between lines in the sand. One column held ones, another tens, and so on. Later versions used beads in grooved trays. 1200 abacus. The first abacus was created centuries earlier, but the Chinese developed the divided counting frame we know today. The Chinese version can handle calculations up to 1 billion. Then 1617, Napier's bones. Frequently made of ivory, these number-etched rods were created by John Napier, a Scottish mathematician. By arranging the rods side by side, one could multiply and divide large numbers. Isaac Newton often used a set in his calculations. And 1560, the sector. Credited to several inventors, including Galileo, the sector, or military compass, solved geometry and trigonometry problems, such as predicting the trajectory of a cannonball. 1400, Kaipu. These cords, often made of katan, were used throughout the empire. Data such as census figures were encoded in the type, number, and location of the knots. Some believe that kupas were also used to communicate another non-numerical information. 1632, the slide rule. Anglican minister William Oughtred introduced the first convenient tool to calculate logarithms. With a few improvements, the slide rule became an indispensable tool well into the 20th century. 1820, arithmometer. The first mass-produced mechanical calculating device, the arithmometer, patented by Charles Xavier Thomas in France, used levers and step drums to turn numeral wheels, producing the answers to basic math problems. Then on to 1886, printing adding machine. A full numerical keyboard and a mechanism for printing receipts made William Seward Burroughs' invention popular not with mathematicians, but with business owners and accountants. 1970, handheld electronic calculator. The first electronic calculator, which debuted in the 1960s, was the size of a typewriter. Within a few years, the machines had shrunk considerably. The first handhelds, still capable of only basic functions, cost about $400. And lastly, 2011, Digital Assistant. Since the introduction of Apple's Siri and her cousins, including Alexa, all you need is your voice to solve complicated math problems, a recent study of smart speakers found that young adults ask the devices math questions 2 to 3 times a week. Okay, let's round out the show with the final article in the prologue section under Oceans with an article written by Eric Goebel. It's titled, My, What Big Teeth You Have! Reimagining the Megalodon, the World's Most Terrifying Sea Creature. When I reached the world's preeminent sculpture of long-dead monsters, he was standing atop a ladder inside a 16-foot-tall section of a megalodon tail that was propped upright in his warehouse-sized studio. I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm inside a bathroom, Gary Staub said on his cell phone. The tail was part of a 52-foot-long life-size model of the prehistoric shark that Staub was custom-building for the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. The mighty megalodon, terror of the ancient oceans, could grow to 60 feet long, with a mouth stretching for more than 9 feet wide and a bite force stronger than any other creature, living or dead. The violent damage it caused to its prey and the rows of serrated teeth have given the shark the reputation of an enormous prehistoric jaws, a great white on steroids, says Hans Suess, chair of paleobiology at the museum. In fact, Suess says, evidence suggests that megalodons, which lived between 23 million and 3.6 million years ago, were more closely related to modern mako sharks than to great whites, giving them more slender bodies than great whites and a bronzy back befitting a predator that preferred coastal waters. Plentiful megalodon teeth and a number of calcified vertebrae have been found in ancient seafloors that are now exposed, in the cliffs along the Chesapeake Bay, for example. Those fossils were all Staub was going to get. Like modern sharks, the megalodon's skeleton was made from cartilage, which decomposes. So, to design the model, he and his museum collaborators used a formula that extrapolates from the tooth length and body geometry of modern relatives, and found that his shark would be 24 feet across the front fins. That's the size of a Cessna, he told me. To bring the shark to life, Staub then hand-sculpted a detailed 6-foot-long clay model, laser-scanned the sculpture, and milled 386 foam pieces that, when assembled, become a full-scale prototype, the foam itself being too flammable for museum's display. Next, he fabricated 21 fiberglass panels on top of that, with interior ribs that aligned and bolted together. In April, the model was broken down and trucked from Staub's home in Kearney, Missouri, to Washington, D.C. On the museum floor, Staub reassembled the behemoth from the inside before crawling out a section in the tail. The shark was touched up with epoxy and fresh paint and raised 85 feet in the air to hang menacingly above museum visitors dining in a new cafe. My job is to not have a style, he said, but rather to be the animal, to make that thing as believable as possible. Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the June edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.